Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop and joined alongside me, well, you guys get it, Shelby Kang. Shelby, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Also joined behind you, we have a cute little puppy.
That's right. Yeah, he's this little gentleman behind me, if you happen to be fortunate enough to be able to watch this episode. This it's funny, he's asleep right now, completely just passed out, which is not normal for him. He's normally pretty active, but yeah, he's been working in my space with me, my one-year-old Shiba Inu, and he reminds me when it's 5 o'clock, because that's when we go to the park, and he reminds me when it's time to eat and when it's time to go to sleep. So if my wife's not around, he's the one that keeps me honest.
And if you needed any more reason to check out the video, a cute Shiba Inu is, I mean, that's the best one I could possibly come up with.
Yeah, so hard sell on the video. So yeah, we've expanded into multiple platforms, and hopefully, if you're not listening to this on a platform that you're used to, or you're a new listener, it's partially because we've expanded the number of platforms that we're on, and even trying to expand some of the mediums that we're broadcasting this podcast through. So hopefully, if you enjoy it, you'll take the time to share it or leave a review. We really appreciate it, and I want to welcome all of our new listeners and viewers. And I guess that leads us to Shelby. What's on the docket today?
Yeah, so the first topic I wanted to talk about comes from What's New in Publishing, and it's about how Facebook is secretly penalizing publishers. So a new report from an AI-powered social publishing platform studied more than 250,000 unique Facebook posts last month. So the report found that Facebook algorithms, whether directly or as an indirect consequence, penalizes publishers for posting either too frequently or too infrequently. And most publishers are completely unaware of this. So to understand how these penalties are impacting publishers and to quantify their efforts in terms of lost traffic, the researchers studied how different intervals between posts affected traffic for leading news, lifestyle, and sports publishers. So they analyzed the time elapsed in minutes, so from 1 to 60 between two published posts, and they also looked at the average change in referral traffic from Facebook for each interval. So this allowed them to determine when a publisher could post within any given hour before being penalized and when a publisher should post to generate an increase in traffic. So for example, they examined data for two top news publishers and observed that for both, posts spaced less than 10 minutes apart resulted in a decrease of referral traffic, and the decline in traffic was particularly steep when the posts were less than 5 minutes apart. So posts spaced roughly 10 to 40 minutes apart resulted in a slight increase in Facebook traffic. So that appears to kind of be the sweet spot for those publishers. But the relationship between post frequency and penalization is not really linear. So beyond the 40-minute mark, penalization occurs again with more referral traffic dips. So when publishers post at certain frequencies, whether it's too often or not enough, the algorithm appears to penalize the publisher's Facebook page by not displaying those posts in the news feed. So as a result, these publishers miss out on opportunities for reach and to gain traffic for the posts. Over the course of a single day, these hidden penalties result in significant traffic opportunities that are pretty much being wasted. But I just thought this was interesting because it says that a lot of publishers don't really realize what's happening. I don't even think that I would, you know, be able to realize it. And it's just like, when you're posting on these platforms, you're just at the whim of all these invisible rules, which seems really frustrating.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, this is something that I think anybody that's done a lot of social media content marketing before is probably somewhat familiar with, but it becomes a very I'm trying to think of the best way to describe it, but it's like a very inexact quote unquote science, because it's really just sort of like, it's like baking without directions, you know, it's like a pinch of that, a pinch of this. And so I think that those are things that people have kind of inherently understood before. And now as we're getting a little bit more data, you're seeing how Facebook is trying to train page operators and publishers to basically engage with visitors the way that they want them to. You know, there's a cadence for the way that the newsfeed, they would desire it to operate. And that means fresh content regularly, but maybe not too regularly. And so I think that this is something that I understand the frustration, but you also have to realize like these are the same types of things that are dictating Google organic search and things like that. And so I think if you're going to, you know, have it as a part of your strategy to optimize around these platforms, you know, you're going to have to just stay up to date on this. And I'd love to be able to say, hey, do this or do that and push back. But, you know, when these are the mediums, these are the mechanisms and the levers that you have to pull as a publisher in terms of marketing your content, you know, you just need to be on the cutting edge as best you can, because this will change. I mean, there's one thing that's certain, it's some level of that or aspect of it will change, and maybe dramatically. That's actually the only for sure thing that we can say about it.
So the best way to kind of test that out would just be, I'm assuming, to just post at different frequencies and trying to figure out what works for that time.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a publisher, you're probably going to, over time, bleed down your reach from low engagement and things like that. So I would really focus on strategically trying to find stuff that you felt like would perform really well and trying to engage your audience as best as possible. And then you could probably get a pretty decent idea for what that cadence looks like. But yeah, I mean, when you think about regularly, but maybe not too regularly, you're thinking, you know, you maybe want to try multiple times a day, maybe try once a day and see where you can find that balance. You know, if you're probably only posting like once or twice a week, that's probably not frequent enough for someone like Facebook. I mean, I have so many pages that I'm the admin on. I'm constantly getting notifications about like, hey, you haven't updated your followers in a long time or something like that. So that's probably, if you're getting those notifications, it's probably one key that you're not posting frequently enough.
All right. The next topic I wanted to cover this week is from Search Engine Journal, and it's about how Google Web Stories now has an official WordPress plugin. So this plugin makes it easier for WordPress publishers to create content in Google Web Stories format, enabling publishers to attract more visitors. So this plugin was previously available at GitHub as a beta version, but it's now available as a full WordPress plugin. The Web Stories is a way to use existing content to create short form content that can be snacked on quickly.
Oh, I hate that. Whenever marketers come up with these words that are just, they seem so boardroomy.
So content that is in Web Story format can be seen at the top of regular Google search. It can also appear in Google Images, in Discover, and on the Google app. There are some kind of fussy requirements for content and how it should be formatted for Web Stories. So videos should be vertically oriented horizontally. And additionally, the minimum font size must be 24 pixels. And there should be no more than 200 characters on each Web Story page. So this new plugin features a drag and drop interface and templates to make it really easy to create Web Stories. And they've also partnered with stock image and video providers to make free images and videos available to the plugin users too. So I thought that was a cool new feature. I mean, I haven't personally consumed a lot of these Web Stories, but you know, if they become more available for publishers to create, then maybe they'll start appearing more. I just feel like I don't really go to Google for that kind of content to begin with, so I don't really know how that's going to catch on or if it'll catch on, but I guess we'll wait and see. Do you have any predictions about it?
I mean, it's AMP stories with Web Stories thrown in front of it so that it doesn't sound like it's AMP. I mean, we experimented with it for a couple different things, probably a little over a year ago. It did not see a lot of pickup or a lot of, I guess, reach or impressions in terms of search. Could just been our subject matter and things like that. If they want to push it, they probably can, but it's a limited application in a lot of respects. When you think about stories or, you know, whatever mechanism, it's, you know, like all the social platforms have some version of this now, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, you know, they kind of like, you know, full phone screen kind of story. And I know you can do it on desktop too. It's just lame. And the thing is that it does not really answer questions super well. Meaning like there's not a lot of things that I'm searching for where I'm like, you know what I want? Is I want like an Instagram story. I want a Snapchat of this information. Like it's not something that people want. And I understand that it's a unique and kind of a cool format, and to be able to have it indexed in search makes sense. So I'm actually, if you're a publisher, I think that you may have content sometimes that lends itself to stories. Is that something that makes sense to appear in search results? I mean, realistically, probably not. The one that I've seen recently is, I remember on my phone, I Googled Seth Rogen for a reason. I was trying to figure out how old he was, and I saw that I had a story. And so I clicked through it, and they basically, Google had curated and basically scraped the content off of Wikipedia and IMDb and just kind of populated this story with Seth Rogen information. And I remember thinking at the time, like, this is kind of cool if I wanted to watch like a brief Seth Rogen slideshow, but that's not really what I wanted. So when people Google that, I can't imagine that's their desired result. And Google is pretty good about, I don't know, what people are looking for, trumping pretty much every one of their initiatives, because they've, you know, they've certainly tried to press a lot of things and that ultimately users don't want, and those things kind of make their way to the back. But I mean, we'll see, I guess.
Yeah. Do you think it's worth giving it a try if you do have content that kind of fits the bill?
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of trying just about anything. I would say don't just throw something at the wall. Like actually try to come up with a creative idea where you think your content would lend itself to stories, and then try to think about how you could make that in a way that, you know, aligns with some potential queries. And yeah, give it a shot. It's not that hard. And actually, I think the process of actually creating one and that sort of thing might teach you a lot about just kind of unique emerging formats. Because I do think that if you're a publisher and you largely just publish through your CMS or something like that, I think that you're missing out on what I believe will be an emerging trend, which is more like elaborate formats or more engaging formats that will become available in the future or interactive. And those are things that you're going to have to learn how to publish outside of your CMS in a lot of cases. So yeah, I would say it's worth a try, if nothing else, just to develop some skills.
All right. And the last topic I have on deck is from Niche Publishing Network, and it's about a new report on media. So this report studied 10,000 consumers across France, Germany, Spain, the UK, and the US, and looked at how digital media consumption and attitude towards advertising has changed during 2020. So the report found that ads performed better in trusted environments, with 67% of consumers more likely to engage with an ad on a website of a publisher they know and trust. So over half of the consumers studied said that they would feel negatively towards a brand that advertised next to false or misleading content. They also found that, as expected, content consumption is up significantly since COVID-19 started, with the average consumer doubling the time they spend consuming content each day. So people aren't just consuming more content, they're also being more selective in the type of content and channels that they view it through. So 24% of these people surveyed have newly subscribed to a free publication with access to trusted information in the last few months. So I know we always take these studies and this research with a grain of salt, but I did want to bring this up because there has been, you know, more and more discussion about trust and publishing, and obviously fake news is a big thing that gets thrown out there a lot. I'm sure it depends on the publisher and the content that there is, but you know, how important really is trust in publishing?
So I did see this study, and so to answer your last question, how important is trust in publishing for advertisers or for brand placement or whatever? So let me say this, because I believe this wholeheartedly as somebody who's been in advertising and publishing for a really long time. I do think that context makes a giant difference. There is value in having ads or advertising associated with name a brand media publisher that you hold in high regard. And I think that there's value there that is really difficult to measure because the measurements that we have don't really reflect how someone feels or how someone perceives the fact that, you know, Nike is advertising in the Washington Post or something like that. Or that's maybe where they discover, you know, Nike's new Black Lives Matter campaign or something like that. So I think, you know, as a brand, there's definitely a strategy from an advertiser standpoint that you might want to take when it comes to brand media publishers, meaning like maybe your biggest, newest campaign comes out on those platforms first or something like that. And they are more valuable. That said, this study is like a big eye roll for me. So the organization and then the people associated with doing the study, where their sole responsibility and their sole goal is to basically prove this, did a study that proves exactly what they would imagine they would want to prove. And like I said before, the metrics that we're talking about here, they're meaningless from the standpoint of give me the same metrics and give me a handful of websites that no one considers a brand. And I bet I can hand pick or cherry pick a whole bunch that get even better engagement metrics. Is that the same value as something like the New York Times or, you know, something like that? No, I think those things are different. Does that mean that the ad placements on these sites that are getting great engagement that aren't brands are much lower value? No, not necessarily. There's value in like real non-fraudulent ad placements just about anywhere as long as it doesn't, you know, this term brand safety, I hate it, Shelby. I hate it because anytime somebody starts talking about brand safety, my first thought is whatever platform they're trying to tell me about or whatever they're trying to say that is brand safe, it's probably not. And I probably need to audit any campaigns that I've got running on there. It's the difficulty of programmatic environment. This when you start delivering on campaigns at scale across the web, you're going to have issues like this. I don't believe that in this day and age that there's anybody that if they see, you know, a McDonald's ad next to extremist content, that they think to themselves, McDonald's must believe in extremism because they put their ad next to this content. Maybe a small handful, but I think most people are understanding that they have some understanding of the way that digital advertising works. And so I think that there's a certain amount of forgiveness there. Does that mean you want to prevent it because you obviously don't want to show ads in those locations for a lot of different reasons? No. So I think it should really be more about understanding and auditing where your ads show and to whom. And I think that if you're an advertiser, you inherently understand that, you know, media brands have a unique value in of themselves. But I think any attempts to basically demonstrate this value using engagement or eyeball tracking or CTR or anything like that, you're going to shoot yourself in the foot because those are metrics that you could use to prove a lot of other things too. And I don't know that they demonstrate the value that sort of what is claimed.
All right. That's actually all the topics that I've got going on this week. Is there anything else you want to add in?
I will say that one of the things that I really enjoyed here recently was an interview that I did with Simon Andrews. I think we talked about it maybe on the last show, but it is up on YouTube now. I saw pubops.org. I think it's up on their site, but it's also probably up on YouTube. It was really, really fascinating. If you enjoy kind of like the bleeding edge of what's happening in digital, Simon is like my go-to for a lot of things. And him and I are chatting once a month as a part of a series of content that we're doing with them. And it's really, really fascinating. So I'd encourage people to check it out. That being said, Shelby, anything else?
That's all for this week.
All right. We want to thank everyone for joining us on another episode of The Publisher Lab.